All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckaholics? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. What's happening? I did it. Yesterday was my 18th sober birthday. I can toot my own horn once a year, get my coin. Sarah the painter, she gave me a coin. It was nice. Got some nice congrats from people on the Twitter and on in my family and friends. 18 years without a cocktail, a puff of weed, a line of blow, however you do meth. No, nothing. Just this goddamn nicotine lozenges and this goddamn coffee, but nothing that makes my life unmanageable and destroys my health and world and ability to cope and do things. Yes. Yes. I'll take it. 18 years yesterday sober. I made it. Today is just another day. We're back to it. We're back to a day at a time. How are you people doing? I still don't feel physically great. And I do believe that it's going to come down to me. I'm probably going to have to get off of these nicotine lozenges again and probably the coffee. And some of you have been with me long enough to know what that's like. We've been through this before. But I'm surprised at the parts of the addict brain that I still have. Let me tell you, I was working out with the lady that helps me work out today. And she's like, you just got to do it. You just got to go cold turkey. You got to just get off the, you know, the nicotine and the caffeine. And I defended it like a goddamn junkie. I was like, no, I wouldn't. She goes, do you want to? I'm like, no, I don't. I don't want to. It was that tone. She's like, don't you want to quit those? And I'm like, no, I don't. I don't know how the hell I'll cope. I don't know what the hell I'll do. I don't know how I'll feel okay about life in the world. It's already hard enough without caffeine and those nicotine suckers. I don't know what the fuck. What the fuck am I going to do? Don't. No, I do not. Justified it. Justified my low-level self-medicating like a goddamn junkie. I'm sober from the bad shit, but this stuff is, I don't know. I think it's making me queasy. Something's making me queasy. Maybe it's just stress and fucking insanity in the goddamn world. Maybe the Trump reign of terror is starting to crush me on a neurological level. That's the plan, right? You get about a third of the country that loves you no matter what the fuck you do, no matter who the fuck you bomb or who you hate on or what chaos you unleash on the world, on the country. And then you got about the other two-thirds of people just terrified. And that just makes that one-third laugh and excited that maybe they'll one day get us all to leave or watch us die. Yeah, that kind of stuff. All this nuclear saber rattling. Yeah, that maybe that's making me queasy. Does that sound like a reasonable reaction to that? Let's not dwell. I've 18 years sober, but that doesn't change the world. It doesn't change anything. It's just another day where I don't drink or use drugs and try to deal. Oh, let me tell you who's on the show. We got a little bit of a doubleheader going. My old pal John Ronson is here. The very intelligent, witty, and smart writer. John Ronson has a new audio series for Audible. It's called The Butterfly Effect. The entire series is available for free at audible.com/butterfly effect. And then after him, we've got Canadian Mike McDonald. Old comic. I don't want to call him too old. He's probably about 10 years older than me, maybe a little less. But I do have to qualify him as Canadian Mike McDonald, not Mike McDonald, the singer, not Mike McDonald, the comic from Boston. Mike McDonald, not that Mike McDonald. I'm doing a bad impression of a guy that most of you don't know. Mike McDonald. No, it's Canadian Mike McDonald. He's been through the war of the road. Has some physical issues, a survivor, a real comedy life survivor who I met years ago, who has been around for a long time, and he had some health problems and stuff, and then he he's doing a some sort of filming thing around here, and I came over and we talked for about an hour. He's a real comedy warrior, Mike McDonald. So he's coming up. But let's read a couple of pleasant emails. This one, I don't mean it to be a plug, but you can certainly take it that way. Waiting for the Punch is the subject line. That's the name of the WTF book coming out that you can pre-order now. I really had no intention of doing a plug, but this is a nice email. Hi, Mark. I work at an indie bookstore in Connecticut and was able to get an advanced copy of Waiting for the Punch. I wanted to tell you that it was great. I was apprehensive at first that it was just blurbs from episodes that I've already heard, but the book is so finely curated and the excerpts are so impactful, I was barely aware I was reading from interviews I had already heard. Attempting Normal, that's my other book, had a huge impact on me and helped me through a tough divorce. And this new book comes at a time of transition for me as well and had a similar impact. I just wanted to tell you your comedy and your books have gotten me through some really dark days, and I'm forever grateful for that. Chris wrote that. Well, good, Chris. I'm glad you got a copy of that. That seems to be the way people are responding to the book, and I'm glad to help out, and I'm glad you had that reaction to the book, which you can pre-order at WTFpod.com. Just click on that book thing. Yeah, click on it. Go get it. Go get it before it comes. This is an email that I never anticipated. I didn't think this would happen. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with the feelings that this email brings out of me. It says, "Meet Baby Marin." That subject line will grab you. Like, I knew this was going to happen. Oh my God, how old is it? He or she? Where did this happen? Where are you from? How much do you want? What's happening? Not that kind of email. "Hey, Mark, my name is Wally. My wife, Chanel, and I are huge fans and truly love your work. We live in Brantford, Ontario, Canada, and we listen to the podcast. We love your TV show and just recently saw you live for the first time at the Danforth Music Hall in Toronto. My wife is especially endeared to your no bullshit, brutally honest, and vulnerable approach. On to the point, though. When thinking of unique names for our second child, one of the first things my wife thought of was Marin, and it stuck. What? It wasn't a pregnancy without its struggles, and baby Marin proved to be just as difficult to deal with as you portray yourself to be at times. He wound up being nearly 2 weeks overdue, required a C-section to deliver, and at 9 pounds, 2 ounces, I doubt she would have wanted to push the hulking beast out of herself anyway. She's been through a lot, and is currently, as I write this, still in hospital recovering. Both mama and baby are happy and healthy as I come home to get some sleep before having to go back to my day job as a welder in the morning. It would mean the world to me if you could just give her a shout out on the air and give her a little extra boost of morale from her favorite cranky little man. I write that lovingly." All right, Chanel, good job. I'm glad you had to get it out of you somehow, and I'm glad the kid is out and he's doing all right. Is it a boy? Yes, it's a boy. I'm glad little Marin is good. I'm glad it's not mine, but only in namesake. And I'd like to welcome little Marin into the world, and best of luck with it. And I'm glad you're okay. And here he says, "I've included photos of your infant namesake, and I dare say he may be just a touch cuter than you, big Marin. All the best, Wally." Oh, kid. So that happened. There's a kid out there with my name, my last name is his first name, and I hope it's easier for him coming up with that name. It's very flattering and very, I can feel no other way other than honored and I'm glad that the kid's all right. So let's move into it. So this is me talking to John Ronson about his new audio series called The Butterfly Effect. It's on Audible, and it's available for free at audible.com/butterfly effect. Enjoy. So I haven't seen you in a while, and apparently you're doing things.
Yeah, since I saw you last. The last time I saw you, I was in the midst of my public shaming.
Oh yeah, how did that? I imagine that book changed lives.
Yeah, there was a lot of pushback, though. Like, we were just talking about Randy Newman.
What was the whole name of the book again?
So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Yeah, I read that book. I've read most of your books. You're one of the guys that I read the books and when I prepare. I read them.
Thank you.
You and Sam Quiñones and Bruce Springsteen.
That's where I feel I belong. thank you. So that was the last time I saw you.
What was the pushback?
Oh.
Did they try to shame you? Was that the backlash of writing a book about public shaming is that you were trolled and shamed?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. It was a pain in the fucking neck.
What happened?
Well, because my book is like, it's against the sort of culture of shaming. So obviously people who enjoy shaming people.
Oh, you fucked with their hobby?
Yeah, I fucking did. It was
you buzzkilled the assholes, the troll army. The army of unfuckable hate nerds came after you.
And it was noisy.
Oh,
and it
I lasted. Bet.
And it was relentless. Noise for about
no
a
kidding.
Year.
Like, what was the angle?
Oh, every angle you can possibly think of. Because one of the people I was nice about in the book was this woman, Justine Sacker, who's like a white, who, you know, on the surface of things is like a kind of privileged white woman.
Yeah. The one who, the South Africa thing?
Right. So I then became like, John Ronson's only nice about privileged white people.
Oh, they were accusing you of virtue signaling?
Yeah. Well, virtue signaling on the... Well, both... Ugh.
Both sides. Oh, you both got it from sides. All angles.
Yeah, I got it from all
You got the
angles.
Righteous trolls and just the monster trolls.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I got the lot of them.
There's so, you know, there's so many unimaginative people that live to cause, you know, start shit. That is their... That's their creativity. Is causing problems.
I was thinking a lot about consequences.
Yeah, because of working on the shame book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I asked this guy one time who'd started this onslaught against this woman, like a Gorka journalist. I said, how did it feel to have started the onslaught against her? And he said, it felt delicious.
And I hate the way they use that word.
Yeah. And then he paused and said, but I'm sure she's fine now.
Yeah.
And I happen to know that, you know, she was depressed and she wasn't leaving her house.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was probably having suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
But for cognitive dissonance reasons, you know, you have to think that they're fine. You don't want to think there's consequences because, you know, you're a nice person, yet you've just destroyed somebody's life. So to make that work inside your head, you have to pretend that they're fine.
Or you have enough kind of sociopathic detachment to think that it just happens online and that's it. It's like a person who rages. When they're done yelling, they're like, are we good?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about like how, you know, for the internet to work, you have to sort of not think about the consequences of your actions.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, where else does that exist on the internet? And the place where I thought it really existed is porn. So a few things happened. Could I tell you these things that happened?
Yeah.
Okay. I, for my shamed book...
Oh, you went on a porn set?
Yeah, I went on a porn set.
Yeah, I remember.
Which was great. I'm actually in a porn. I am briefly in a porn film called Public Disgrace because it was my first ever porn set and I wanted to like see what was happening. So I kind of leaned in.
Yeah.
This was a woman was getting her genitals electrocuted. And I thought...
For real?
Yeah, because in a break from the filming, everybody like... thought, well, this can't be real, because it was like set in a bar in the valley.
Yeah.
And the conceit was that Princess Donna, the porn star, was pulling in this woman called Jodie Taylor and would then like electrocute her genitals in front of everybody in the bar. So during a break...
What kind of porn is this?
Well, it's weird porn. It's humiliation porn.
Okay.
And so everybody was like testing the electrocution machine during a break, and it really was giving electric shocks. It was real. So I kind of peered in. I said, so somewhere in a film called Public Disgrace, there's like a tweedy gentleman holding a notepad, like peering in. Like, I'm just hoping that for somebody out there, that's a nice
promo for that film.
I remember my big memory of that night. I have two memories of that night.
Yeah.
One is that... like, it started late. It started at like 10:30, and I was still on New York time. So
kind of like hazy.
Yeah. So like 1 a.m., I was just thinking, please ejaculate so I can just go home. And then I thought, God, I'm like thousands of women before me. Please ejaculate so I can go to sleep.
Can we just get closure on this?
Yeah.
Some messy closure on this situation. I'm tired.
And my other memory was that when I was meeting Princess Donna, so I was staying that night at this fancy Los Angeles hotel, the Chateau Marmont.
Yeah.
So I was in my room, and the guy, the receptionist, phoned up and said, "Your guest is waiting for you downstairs."
Yeah.
So I went downstairs, and everybody else in the lobby was dressed like, exactly like I'm dressed now, in that James Pierce grey hoodies.
Celebrity hiding.
Yeah, exactly. Like a celebrity burka, grey hoodie, which I just sort of hide underneath.
So it makes everybody go, is that, I don't know, is it?
But except for Princess Donna, who was dressed like this kind of great mad peacock.
Yeah.
She looked like so otherworldly.
Hollywood.
Yeah, and I wore porn, and I walked towards her, really interested in it, like she was interesting to me. And
peacocks are interesting.
Yeah, so I, especially in the context of grey sweatpants.
Yeah.
So I looked around, and I noticed the receptionist, as I was walking towards her, and the receptionist was looking at her.
Uh-huh.
And the look, he didn't realize anybody was looking at him, looking at her. And the look on his face was one of contempt. Like disgust. And it made me think, it made me think that some people are only comfortable with porn people when they're on their computers and not in their vicinity.
Sure.
And so I became curious, like after my little mini porn experience.
Well, do you think he knew she was a porn person?
I think he knew she was some kind of sex worker. You know what? Even if...
It's weird though, because that street, there, you know, at a different era...
Yeah.
Was just like a parade of that. When I was at the Comedy Store in the late 80s, it was all over the place.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I could have misread. It's possible that I misread the situation.
He probably just was, he thought she was being a little bit much for the chateau.
And funnily enough, I brought this up with another porn star a couple of weeks later.
Yeah.
And she took the side of the receptionist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck her.
Well, Benham basically said, she should have dressed more demurely.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I might have misread the situation, but it did make me curious about the lives of porn people. And so I started reading their blogs and so on, and what were their concerns. And what I realized was that a lot of porn people were concerned about the very same, very specific thing. And it was a man called Fabian.
Yeah.
And I became really interested in Fabian.
What does that mean?
Fabian's a guy called Fabian Tillman.
Yeah.
And he's a Brussels entrepreneur.
Uh-huh.
And when he was a teenager, he had an idea. And the idea was basically to get rich and giving the world free porn, online porn.
Oh.
So he didn't invent porn.
I am personally grateful.
Right. Well, you and 75 million other people every day.
The weird thing that, just I know I'm getting ahead of you, but that what it enables you to do is not invest as much time. You know, internet porn, free porn, enables you to use it as a drug, which is what it is. Like, you know, it's like, I got 6 minutes, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to invest in a story. You don't really have to fast forward. There's plenty available.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm not proud of it. I'm not saying I'm compulsive about it, but it's nice knowing it's there, right?
Right. Well, it's certainly taken off in a big way.
The business itself, whether it's free porn or not, must be a massive business still for somebody.
Mm.
And because there is literally, not unlike troll culture or social networking, is that the globe and America in particular has become completely pornified and almost embraces it.
Mm.
That, you know, coming out of the 80s where there was a commission put together to fight it, that now it's sort of like, it's just matter of fact. How does that happen? It must be about money.
Yeah, well, I can answer all of those questions. I'm now an expert at Pornhub economics.
Yeah.
So Fabian, by the way, got so rich from owning Pornhub and basically buying up the entire San Fernando Valley, pretty much. Like at one point in about 2012, 80% of everybody in the world who watched porn was watching it on one of Fabian's sites.
But then doesn't the model become more of a YouTube model for performers?
Well, eventually it sort of turned into that. But the foundation, I should explain, by the way, Mark, that all of this I've just made this audio series called The Butterfly Effect.
Yeah.
And the flap of the butterfly's wings is Fabian giving the world free porn.
Oh.
And the entire series is about the consequences. And it goes out and out and out. So to the strangest places.
Yeah.
Like our sort of challenge to ourselves is, if you follow consequence through to consequence, like from Fabian giving the word free pod, where the fuck are you going to end up? And you end up with a man in Norway having his expensive stamp collection destroyed by three women. So that's like one of the places we end up by chasing this butterfly thing. But let me tell you about...
That's one of those weird things where it's a spoiler, but it's so compelling and you cannot figure out the story.
So where the fuck are you... How the fuck do you get from one to the other?
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Fabian... Fabian bought Pornhub when it was like a fledgling company owned mm-hmm. by these guys up in Montreal. He wanted to expand. Like, that wasn't enough for him. So he got a bank loan to expand. Now, one real irony, like Pornhub was, the foundation of Pornhub was pirated porn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't upload pirated porn themselves, but they kind of allowed a space for users, for
pirated
fans.
Meaning not original?
Stolen.
Yeah.
So company would make a porn film, and then the day it's released on DVD,
yeah.
somebody would just upload it onto Pornhub, and it would stay on Pornhub, but everybody would watch it for free.
Right.
So all the mom and pop porn production companies would have to close down. Porn stars would have to go into like escorting to
right,
pay
right.
the rent. Mm. And everybody was watching their porn for free on Pornhub, pirated. Now, if anybody said to Pornhub, can you take down this porn belongs to us and it's illegally uploaded, yeah. they'd go, oh, sorry, we'll take it down, and they'd take it down.
Right.
But by then, like, all the porn in the world was, like, on Pornhub for free. So, yeah. you know, it was like trying to cut down a forest with a butter sure. knife.
It's a lot like YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Fabian wanted a bank loan to help him expand.
A band clone?
A bank loan.
Bank loan.
Yeah,
okay.
like a loan from like,
I thought you were talking some tech term that I didn't know. Bank loan.
Yeah, bank loan.
Got it.
Now, one irony in all of this is that if you're a woman in porn, if you're a porn performer
yeah.
and you go to a bank manager and ask for like a checking account, they might turn you down because it's like you're deemed disreputable.
Yeah.
But Fabian, he wasn't like a porn performer, he was a tech entrepreneur. So he got a $362 million loan to build an empire based in part on the handling of those women's stolen porn.
Yeah.
So with this loan, he bought up like, you know, loads of like porn production companies in LA. And within a year, he was like, he owned like...
All of it.
Yeah, he owned all of it for all intents. I mean, not all of it, but he owned a shit.
So it was no longer the quaint family business it once was.
No.
Like, it's sort of like the transition from, you know, in Boogie Nights, that shift from, you know, the theaters to the video.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, like, it was also documented a bit in the Tales from Times Square when you know, it moved out of the theaters into the quarter slot, into the
right.
coin-operated booths. There's been several different
yes.
evolutions of it. And I imagine David Simon's new series is going to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. That was like Times Square. But what's happening now is, you know, the sort of porn DVD culture turned into like free porn on Pornhub. And I was really interested in the consequences. Like, no one who worked up at Pornhub HQ ever went on a porn set.
Right, but like, so initially you were interested in personal consequences, or it seems like this thing kind of came around the side for you, it seemed like what you were looking for was something shame-based, and then it kind of became this
yeah.
other thing.
Well, consequence-based.
Consequence.
Like, yeah, like, to eat the meat, you need to ignore the slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And I think nobody, like, everybody was watching porn for free on Pornhub, and nobody was thinking about the consequences. And I wasn't, like, I didn't know anything about it. I had no idea what impact it was having on people. So I just became curious for that reason. And so I discovered, like, you can imagine, like, some of the consequences are what you'd expect.
Yeah.
Like, you know, porn women having to take up escorting, for instance. But then, as we dug and dug and dug, we found these other consequences which are kind of mind-blowing.
Like?
Well, one of my favorites is, like, from the ashes of the old-style porn
yeah.
business, this new phoenix is rising, and it's the world of bespoke porn.
Bespoke.
Yeah. So, like, if you have a porn film in mind
yeah.
that just doesn't exist anywhere in the world,
oh, okay, okay.
you can get, like, a team
oh,
of professional porn people to make
sure.
a porn film just for you.
Oh, yeah.
But the bespoke porn world is unexpectedly...
You like this one. You like the creativity of it.
Well, it's like such an insight to people's inner lives, because you wouldn't believe some of these bespoke porn films that are being made. So these
of course
are,
I would. I mean, you just told me one about a woman who gets her genitals electrocuted, and that was mainstream.
Yeah, that's mainstream. This one is a company. Okay, so one porn film that we found, one bespoke porn film, was a man in Norway. Yeah. I alluded to this earlier. A man in Norway.
Same guy?
Yeah, he spent his life amassing an incredibly valuable book of stamps.
Yeah.
And his bespoke porn film, just for him, was to pay porn performers in the San Fernando Valley to destroy his stamp collection. By throwing it into the fire while chanting, "Burn, burn."
So the sexual element is subverted somehow. I mean, that's the guy's not quite submissive, but
he got sexual pleasure from seeing this stamp collection, which he clearly
a lifelong obsession.
Yeah, which he regretted. I think he feels like he made a mistake spending.
Well, at least he's got the film of it.
Yeah, 10 films. He's commissioned 10.
How much does it cost to commission something like that? To have some women, you know, naked women come over and burn my garage down. What would that
cost?
Well,
you need a fire marshal, so that's a little bit more. But, you know, like $10,000, I reckon.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I know some porn performers, and maybe, you know, they maybe cut me a deal.
They'll give you a deal. Not long ago, we had one bespoke porn producer tell us that a man had just emailed them and said was requesting a video, and his video was for a porn performer to sit cross-legged on the floor, fully clothed, and saying to the camera, "You are loved. Things may be bad now, but they won't always be. And suicide is not the answer."
Like a known porn performer.
Well, I think in that particular case, like, they got to choose their own.
That's pretty touching.
And yeah.
It kind of, it's almost worthy of museum work.
Yeah.
Video.
Yeah.
It's an art piece.
It is an art piece. Well, they wrote back to him and said, like, this really moved them because obviously, well, it would. And so they wrote back to him and said, "Well, look, we can shoot this really soon."
it was pressing.
Like, before you kill yourself.
Yeah, right.
And he didn't write back to them.
Oh.
So then it was like, what do we do? So they made it for him anyway. They paid the porn performer and made it for him anyway and sent it to him.
And
they haven't heard back. The video is basically this woman sitting on the floor in a house in the valley. It's like this white mansion saying, you know, basically, please don't kill yourself. I mean, I think it's a beautiful video. The one error I could possibly say is that, like, they chose this kind of white mansion. It looks like heaven from a movie. So it's maybe not the best idea to make a bespoke porn film in which you're kind of convincing somebody to not kill themselves on a set that basically looks like heaven from an 80s film. Hmm. But she's sort of, she's sitting cross-legged on the floor and she's saying, you know, lots of people love you. I love you. I have thought about dying myself in the past, but, you know, I've pulled myself back from that. And, you know, please don't do it. You know, please stick with us. And then she blows a kiss at the camera.
Mm.
And they sent the video to this guy, and who knows?
Well, John, I'm not disappointed in your reporting. What do you mean, who knows?
Well, I mean, I guess we could track the guy down.
Yeah, what are you talking about? You're not going to do follow-up? You're just going to end on the horrible, sad, existentially sort of provocative
possibility that he hasn't got back to them because he's
dead,
or hasn't got back to them because actually he just wanted to get off on a video of a woman telling him.
But where is the follow-through, Ronson?
Isn't the not knowing in itself?
There's poetry in that, but you're kind of half a reporter.
All right, I'll fucking find out.
That's right. Find out on the next bunch of butterfly effects. Yeah. Or is this it?
No, there might be more.
Before we get off that other topic, the thing is that if you did your due diligence as a reporter, either end of that story is not going to diminish what happened there. You're just going to have to handle the worst of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it did pull him back or the guy does become interested, the worst that could happen is the dude's just sort of like, I just want to see if they do it. You know, that's the worst that can happen. Any other outcome is another good story.
Yeah. You know, even that story's a good story.
I got emotional and now I'm mad at you.
Right. Well, that story's a good story because he massively moved these porn people. They were, as they were making the video for him, they were themselves crying. because obviously it was kind of triggering stuff from their own
lives.
A lot
of them are very sensitive people.
Yeah.
The women that I know.
Oh, yeah, no question. So even if this guy was just fucking with them.
Yeah.
Mark, have you got tears in your eyes?
I did before they went away.
Right.
The fact that you don't know the guy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what happened.
No, we don't know what happened.
Yeah, I get choked up. I get choked up a lot in here.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry.
I think it's a powerful bit of business.
Yeah.
Now I got to listen to it.
Yeah.
I should have done that before I talked to you, but it's better this way. Sounds like a very compelling series there, John.
Oh, Mark, you wouldn't believe.
Well, I mean, I could talk about porn for a while. I've got my own ideas. The accessibility of it has, and the fact that porn addiction is a very real thing, that, you know, you are creating some sort of psychologically chemical change in your brain.
Oh, no
question. It is absolutely a compulsion. I know guys that are lost in it, man.
Yeah. And you know, erectile dysfunction rates have like shot through the
roof. Of course, because a therapist of mine like put it, like we were talking about, he's also been a guest on the show, that when you are a compulsive masturbator, your primary sexual partner is yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you have a lot of control in that situation.
Yeah. You know,
it's neutering a generation of men.
Yeah. My producer Lena met a sex doll manufacturer at the AVN, you know, the adult industry.
Yeah.
And he said, like, his business is going through the roof since free streaming.
Great.
Porn, because it's so much harder. Like, if you watch porn constantly on, you know, tube sites, it's much harder for you to have sex with an actual human.
Well, you don't get outside. You don't know how to talk. You don't know how to get there.
So more and more people are buying
sex
dolls.
Right, so now it's like a pseudo-necrophilia culture.
Yeah, or just, you know, just compliance and perfection.
Mm. You're talking about, you know, like a emotionless doll that has a compelling vaginal feature and oral feature is perfection?
Or it looks like, I met this guy in Louisiana, who, like, he's probably in his 50s now. When he was, like, in his late teens, he was desperately in love with this girl called Darlene. And they were going to get married, and he loved Darlene more than anything in the world. And then one day Darlene dumped him, like, just left him and refused to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke his heart. And cut to, like, 40 years later, a friend of his says, go on this website, and he finds a sex doll that is identical looking to Darlene.
Oh.
So he buys her.
Mm.
And
it's a love story.
He said that she's better than Darlene because, like, when he shared a bed with Darlene, he'd wake up in the middle of the night and Darlene was, like, right the other side of the bed.
Yeah.
Which was, like, a clue to the fact that their relationship was
right.
Whereas the sex doll, he wakes up in the middle of the night and she's draped around him.
Yeah. Or on the floor, and then he just pulls her back into the bed.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very sweet.
Isn't it?
It sounds like a compelling bit of business that I'm not sure the arc of it is an indication of anything good.
No, it's not, right? It's really not. The arc of it is basically tech people are taking over the world. One of Fabian's employees said to me, like, don't think of me as a porn person. I'm not a piece of garbage peddling smut. I'm a tech person.
Well, this is the same type of detachment that enables a troll to not think they ruin someone's life.
Exactly. Tech people taking over the world. No one really cares because they're giving us what we want, which is free porn on the internet.
It's all the revenge of the nerds. We had no idea it would be apocalyptic.
Exactly. That's the heart of the story. It's tech nerds taking over our lives. We don't care. And the consequences to are boundless.
How does the economic model work now for, like, YouPorn or Pornhub or whatever the other ones are called? Yeah. How are they making the money?
Well, you know, you're right that there's, like, you know, you can set up a page on Pornhub where you can, like, you know, sell your own stuff. But as Mike Quasar said to me, this old style director said to me the other day, like, this incredibly famous porn actor called Janice Griffiths.
Yeah.
Said to him the other day, you know, how can you be anti-Pornhub? Like, my Pornhub page on, you know, maybe like $3,000 last month.
Yeah.
And she's like one of the most successful porn stars. And Mike said to her, like, 20 years ago, you'd have made like 30 grand. Yeah. So they don't know. Like, they don't know that they're part of this business that's just that's just eating away at the kind of money that they used to make.
This is all very specific to to who you talk to and to, you know, this business model. But I mean, if you go on to any of these sites, you're like, there's plenty of people making fuck movies. There's no short, to the point where I'm like, I don't know what my neighbor's doing right now. You know?
Yeah. Which, by the way, is part of the problem, because you've got like this massive influx of women in the valley. Like in the old days, in the 90s, there was a kind of, you know, if you wanted to get into porn, you were like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, there was a kind of, there was a sort of outlaw status. And but
sure,
now,
you needed a doctor to give you the pills for, you know, whenever you get manageable sexually transmitted diseases. And it was part of the liability of the work.
Right. But now the valley is full of this kind of massive influx of 18-year-old girls who grew up on Pornhub, think that looks like fun and an easy way of making money.
People who are detached from the input. That's an interesting sort of idea. You know, Wilhelm Reich had, you know, when he kind of hot-rodded Freud's ideas about sexual repression and neuroticism, you know, pictured a world where, you know, sexuality would be completely untethered.
Right, and destigmatized.
From its Victorian constraints. Yeah. And that it would make for a better world.
Yeah, and you know what? That world is kind of starting to happen. And that's the plus side, I would say. I'm with Reich on this. That's like, that's the upside of it. The downside, though, is that, you know, thousands of you know, young 18-year-old girls like arrive in the valley without feeling any stigma about porn, which
and
is obviously
fucking
good.
For money.
Yeah. They work for like a month and then nobody needs to employ them anymore because there's another bunch of girls getting off the bus. So the downside is that
they got to enter the workforce with Pornhub videos on their resume.
Yeah. And and they come here with all those hopes and dreams and they get a month of work and then they're fucked.
Well, I mean, but do you really want to call them hopes and dreams? I mean, like, you know, the thing is that it's still a very male dominated business. And, you know, there's a lot of these 18-year-old girls that I don't know they necessarily really know what they're getting into. And they get, you know, abused and fucked up and strung out. And it, like, I mean, everyone's got free will, but I mean, we are talking 18. You know, it's legal, but it's still young.
Well, my producer Lee and I, we embedded ourselves in the side of the porn industry in the valley where, you know, there's much less exploitation, where the sets are kind of respectful and the women earn good money. So we, you know, we didn't want to go to like the sort of hot girls wanted sort of sleazy side of the industry.
Well, again, due diligence, Ronson. I'm glad you got a balanced bit of
because like I wanted our series to be about the tech takeover of the porn industry.
Okay.
I didn't want it to be about the little dark corners of the industry.
Well, now you've opened up a can of worms, though, man.
No, I stand by that because I never make stories about goodies and baddies, but in this story, if anybody's a baddie, it's the far away tech entrepreneurs who like fucked everything up from afar. So we just wanted to concentrate on that particular story.
Okay. I'm
on
think
board. That's cool. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be
fine with it. I just like it. Yeah. It is something that I don't know has really been like the evolution of porn and the nature of it in our own sort of, you know, kind of conflicted feelings about sex workers in general or how they're characterized. Like, you know, I got an email recently that you know, that I sort of condescend, you know, in humor about, you know, the nature of strippers or hookers or how they're sort of characterized. And I know sex workers and I'm certainly, you know, accept them and the work. And I have a different, I still do jokes sometimes, but I understand the business and that there is respect involved there. But it is still a fairly unexplored, you know, notion, the state of the contemporary porn industry.
Totally. That's why, you know, I really wanted to make that decision to not follow in the footsteps of films like Hot Girls Wanted, which are about the sort of, you know, seedier side of the industry.
I think you're right. It seems like you're riding a line. I like it. And yeah. I like your work, and I was just pushing back a little bit. But I should find out what happened to that guy.
I will.
Thanks, man. There you go. Sounds like a compelling bit of business. I always like talking to John Ronson. So, look, Mike McDonald here. Like, a lot of you may not know him, but I've known him and he's been around for a long time. I remember seeing him on a very early, I think it might have been a Young Comedian special. I'll talk to him about that. But he was one of these guys that, you know, was sort of on the periphery of American comedy a bit. And he, you know, he ran with some of the hardcore dudes that I looked up to and I got tangled up with. And, you know, you get to a certain age in this business where if somebody survives and they're still at it, you know, you're like, good for you, man. You're also, you know, if somebody survives and they got out, you're also like, oh, good for you. What a fucking relief that would be if you can live with yourself. But Mike's not one of those guys. He's the other guy. He's still in it. He's still doing it. He's persevered through some serious health issues. And, you know, I'm glad I got to talk to him because I was afraid he was going to die. And he didn't. And he's doing all right. This is me and Canadian Mike McDonald. Now, am I wrong in remembering that you were once referred to as the doctor? Was that you?
No, not the doctor.
Maybe I'm making it up. I don't know why I would have. But at some point, I remember talking about Sam, about Kennison.
Oh, right.
Coming up to Canada.
Yeah.
And finding you. Did yeah. Sam Kennison call you the doctor?
I believe on that night, yes. Because I was, he had never shot heroin before.
Oh.
So.
You were the guy?
I had everything ready and stuff. And knowing that, you know, the first time you do it, and a lot of people, for every time they do it, they get sick.
Throw up,
and
right.
then they get high.
Yeah.
So knowing that he was like that, as soon as I hit him up, I undid the band and...
Yeah.
When the sensation got up to about his neck, I grabbed him and I said, "One more soul and I get mine back." And I threw him towards the ground. He's going, "Oh, you bastard! Oh, you son of a bitch, McDonald!"
And then he went out.
Yeah.
You know. Oh my God! Yeah. We're laughing about that, but I think the most
heroin addiction. Ah, yeah. Funny.
Most mortals would be like, "What the fuck are they laughing at?"
Yeah, exactly.
Those monsters.
I'm glad those days are over. I think when I hit 30, I decided to quit everything.
Was it 30?
Yeah, around there.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it in a long time. And you're not living in Canada, though, are you?
I had to virtually go back. I was living in Glendale, and I was fine, and everything was great. But then I got sick. And
what was the sickness? What is the sickness?
Liver disease.
And you're shooting a documentary now?
Yeah.
And is it my understanding, I don't know how to put it bluntly, that time is short? I was pitched this as like, he could go any second.
Yeah. Well, there's always a chance you can go any second. But this is more of, I'm finally back to where I was before I got sick.
Oh, really? So you're doing good?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
thank God.
Back on the road, back doing my act
really?
Full time, yeah, and stuff.
Oh my God, I'm so relieved good. Because like what I was under, I misunderstood the documentary to be was like he's got days, maybe weeks to live.
Well, yeah, well, actually, they're hoping because that would be the big finale to the document, and then he died.
He didn't make it.
They're counting on it.
Well, I mean, look, here's the thing about you is I don't know how many people know exactly who you are, but you've been doing comedy for as long as I can. Remember watching comedy, because I remember the first time I saw you, like it was on like a Catch a Rising Star Young Comedian sing, maybe.
Yeah,
and at that time though, right, but at that time you're like these the new wave come,
yeah. The punk comedian.
Yeah but like you were doing
he's edgy.
Yeah, well, you were doing weird bits.
Yeah,
like abstract bits.
Yeah,
it was. Wait, that was the angle.
Yeah.
At the time
I just thought, oh, anything that's funny. And there was a lot of drug fueled stuff.
But then, like, I saw you years later, I think I saw you at Catch a Rising Star when I was in Boston, but then I saw you years later, and you were just this angry, sweaty mess. You're like, like, I'm like, what happened to the new wave guy? You're like, oh, fuck that. Fuck this. Right?
Yeah.
The evolution, the bitterness had taken hold.
Yeah. That was always my my thing that attracted me to a lot of comedians when I was a kid. It was the yelling and stuff, because my father would yell, and I always thought it was great that you could laugh at yelling as opposed to being afraid of it.
Devastated by it. So where did you grow up, though?
In a number of places, because my dad was in the Air Force. So
every In the Canadian Air Force?
Yeah, every 2-3 years we moved somewhere else.
But like, tell me some places in Canada, because I don't know about Canada. I'm thinking about living there soon.
Yeah, Nova Scotia at one point, Greenland.
You were in Greenland?
Yeah. And
we Do you remember it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My favorite posting, he was in Ramstein, Germany, which was NATO headquarters at the time, 1964 to 69, which was a great time to be there because of the music alone.
Sure. How you were like what? And you're like 13?
I was 9, 1964 when I got there. And I remember them taking me on vacation. And we were in Amsterdam, and there's a little coffee house, and it said Jimi Hendrix live tonight. And I went, oh, my God.
Really?
And that's when I realized, oh, if I was 18, I'd be having the time of my life. But I'm 12, and I have to go with my parents to the Ice Capades. You know, it's like, oh, God. I never forgave them for that. I could have seen Hendrix.
And it, you didn't.
And I missed them.
God damn it. But when you but you were into music like that at that age?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have an older brother?
No, that's the thing. I mean, a Jewish kid in my grade 5 class turned me on to Jimi Hendrix. Listen to this, Purple Haze. And I went, oh, my God, that's so different than the Beatles and everything that we were listening to. And,
yeah.
I flipped out on it.
So that was in Germany. And Greenland, like, is it pretty?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great.
And they have a base there? That's not Canadian territory, though, is it?
No.
It's its own place?
Well, they used to have more stuff there in the past, but now they don't. I don't think so.
So when did, do you have brothers or sisters?
Two younger brothers, yeah.
How they doing?
They're doing okay. One's a lounge singer. He goes by Johnny Vegas, which is weird.
Oh, I know him. I saw him in London.
Yeah.
That's your brother?
No, there's a bunch. There's a Johnny Vegas in every country in the world.
I was going to say, that guy didn't look like
he's the Canadian one.
He's the Canadian Johnny Vegas?
Yeah, he's the Canadian.
So they do a kind of like disrupted, chaotic lounge act?
Yeah.
And what's the other one do? The other one end up out of show business?
I'm not sure anymore.
You don't know what the other brother does?
I thought you meant the other Johnny Vegas, because I saw him a long time ago in Edinburgh.
Yeah,
but,
right. That's where
I
saw
him since.
Right.
Yeah.
That might have been where I saw you. Was that like 2006 or something?
Yeah, it could have been around there.
Yeah. What's the other brother do?
My other brother, he's a drummer in a band.
We all ended up in show business.
Yeah, it was weird.
What, is he in a big band like Rush? Is he Neil Peart?
No. He'd be more like walking into Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, that kind of band.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
But they're Canadian?
Yeah, basically.
Do they have a interesting, just short of a good name, Canadian band name?
Yeah, it's called the Awesome Brothers. You know, which is like, oh, well.
Someone doesn't want to make money.
I don't think any of the three of us were any good at titles.
So like what rank was your dad? Was he like a big shot or?
No, he was what you call a warrant officer. It was like the one step before becoming an actual officer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like people that would ask me, did he fly a plane? No, he flew a desk.
You know, but he's one of the best desk pilots.
He was nice and safe
in the Canadian Air Force. And what did your mom do? Just deal with you guys?
She was a traditional stay-at-home mom and stuff for a long time. And then she started working as a medical receptionist in a hospital.
So where did it start leveling off, though? Because I have no sense. Like, I think you're the first guy of your generation, and you were like, you were part of the, you know, the, I think that 80s stand-up boom where everyone could make a buck.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. Back in those days, you could make, $4,000 a week without having a sitcom. It was amazing.
Because there were so many clubs opening
up. Yeah, it was great.
And you were sort of a known guy up in Canada, right?
Yeah, to a point, yeah.
Well, like, what was the Canadian scene, though? Like, when you grew up, where'd you grow up mostly, like, once you got old enough to start giving a shit about things?
I started high school in Ottawa, which was my dad's last posting, and we stayed there for a long time, and that's where I started doing stand-up, and then I moved to Toronto, and then Toronto to LA.
What's the scene like, though? Like, how old were you when you started?
I think it was 22.
Really?
22, 23.
Did you go to college?
No. I barely made it through the 10 years in high school. But yeah, no college, really. I had a series of odd jobs before I decided to become a comedian. And I actually thought at one point it was going to be like I played the drums and I thought music was going to be the ticket.
Yeah, sure.
But and then when I realized that in comedy, I didn't have to have four other people agreeing with everything I said. I could do it myself. So the comedy sort of took over.
But at that time, what were the odd jobs? Like what were you?
Well, at one point, I was a dance instructor for Fred Astaire.
Stop it.
Dance
Come on.
Studios.
Come on.
It was during the disco phase, and we dance all day, and then we dance all night, and you know, I was making like $5,000 a week doing.
So you knew the disco dances?
Yeah, it was weird. It was a weird time, you know. And then when the comedy started, I actually started at what turned into the punk club scene in Ottawa, and there was an audience that you learned the possibilities of good editing.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't like something, they'd let you know.
So, like, so we're talking, like, what year? Like, you're 22, and what year?
It was 1978.
So, like, these punk rock clubs, were they real punk rock clubs, or were they...
Well, there was only one, and, yeah, it was definitely the punk scene. It was, you know, groups like Teenage Head from Canada. I don't know if you heard of it. They were like our version of the Ramones.
Oh, yeah?
And they were like really good. I really enjoyed seeing a lot of the band. I was really into the music still, obviously, but the comedy thing just took off.
Like, but for you to choose that club over, like, you know, why that place? Like, were there comedy? You were in Toronto at this point? Yeah,
well, no, I was in Ottawa still.
Was there Yuck Yucks there yet or anything?
No, Yuck Yucks would come in about 2.5 years later.
So there was nothing?
No, there was no official comedy club whatsoever.
Well, what compelled you? Who did you see that made you think that?
It was a friend of mine was recording local bands and stuff, and he called me in to do something comedy because he had heard this album called Derek and Clive Live.
Yeah.
It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
And they got really drunk, and they turned on the tapes, and they got all this stuff. And some of it was okay. Like, I still remember the joke about, what's the worst job you've ever had? Well, I used to pick lobsters out of Jane Mansfield's bum. You know, and, you know, stuff like that. So my friend, you know.
That's the one that sticks.
Yeah. So my friend who had the studio in his basement, and I'd been in the band with him before, he said, well, why don't we do something with comedy, too? But instead of alcohol, we'll get really high.
Yeah.
And boy, we recorded like 18 hours of tapes that if they heard them now, even, I would have to leave on the next shuttle. I couldn't stay on the planet with their, you know, like I see what people are getting in trouble now. And I go, no, that's nothing compared to these tapes. I mean, oh, my God.
What were you guys doing?
We went anywhere. And on the top it off, we had... the engineer guy, his name was Carl Schultz, and he was German, right?
Yeah.
And for me, the same way that Monty Python used to make fun of Belgians, my go-to was Germans.
Sure.
I used to just do the Nazi stuff to death. And just we'd always make him frustrated. Stop making jokes about, you got to get some more Jews in the train. It's like all that stuff.
Man.
You know, we just hammering this
for hours.
Yeah, for hours. And it was just a bunch of stuff on tape that we should never release. Ever.
Oh, you should. Well, you know, just put a box set together. So it was inspired by like hearing records and
Derek Clive, and of course, you know, the comedy albums I had when in high school and stuff. I remember the first one that really made a big impact was Richard Pryor's Was It Something I Said?
I
thought that was like a brilliant album, and that's the album that my father came in and said, "What the hell are you listening to?"
Right,
because he heard the N-word really loud one day. And so it was like I had to hide his records. And it was just like, you know, the little Richard Pat Boone thing where I had to hide the black records. My dad couldn't hear them.
Was he a real conservative dude?
Yeah, a little bit on that. You know, he just thought it was shocking that I would listen to anything. Somebody saying the N-word over and over.
Was he
uncalled for.
Was he a nice guy? You get along with that guy?
Actually, in his family, he was the one that broke the mold and left. And some people in his family were racist. So he was the one that had a more worldview. But
racist Canadians.
Yeah, he didn't want to hear me listening to somebody yelling out the N-word loudly.
I have such a stilted or fucked up, you know, idea of what's up in Canada. I mean, was it that diverse a culture? to where, you know, racism would be.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think in when we were stationed in Halifax, I noticed racism for the first time in Canada.
Yeah,
and it was like, you know, one black student in the entire school,
right?
And he got into a lot of trouble and a lot of stuff. So,
the one guy.
But the main thing at the time, you know, you're talking 1962, 63. It was mainly Catholics against Protestants. I mean,
right. That's what I thought. And French people against non-French people.
Well, yeah,
right?
That's always been there. Yeah, too.
Catholic against Protestant. So it was
that was weird. Like my mother would tell me to go to the local store to get some milk and stuff, and I'd have to leave the base to go to the store. And on the way to the store, people would grab me and go, "What are you, Catholic?" And I'd try to guess right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
what were you, Catholic?
Protestant. But, you know, I never liked religion to begin with, but I always tried to say the right answer when they asked me. I'd look, "Oh, the guy's got a cross. Catholic, I'm Catholic. All right, get some milk and get out of here."
So you're doing comedy in punk clubs. And that's sort of where you begin to get that style, which was like, because like for me, like you presented yourself that way. But I remember in that special, you were wearing a striped shirt, I think. Is that possible?
Well, it was a multicolored shirt. It was like the bit was the rock star bit with a tennis racket. Yeah,
oh, that's right. So you
the
did
kid
some
pretending to be
some
a
mild
rock star
prop
in his
usage.
Room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but it was definitely sort of surreal. Not a lot of, like, you didn't get the sense of character that you have now.
Yeah, it was totally different. I mean, I look back and I go, what the hell was I thinking? And it was totally different back then. But at the beginning, I think primarily the influence was Steve Martin at the beginning. And then when the Richard Pryor, the first concert film came out, I remember seeing that three, four times a day.
Was that like 79 or something?
Yeah, watching it and then going on at night. And that was a big influence.
So after you do the punk clubs, when do you start? Where do you start doing more venues that aren't comedy clubs?
I started going all the local, like the folk bars, the heavy metal bars. I played in all kinds of music
so that sort of
venues.
That makes sense. So you had to be pretty, you had to grab them pretty quickly.
Yeah, you had to be.
And, yeah.
But it was also the luxury back then, 1979 in Ottawa, most people had never seen live comedy at all.
Right.
So it was kind of a treat. And I had tapes and music and all this stuff. It was like more
big show.
More performance art. Kind of, you know, without the attitude.
Yeah.
But, you know what I mean? But they just thought it was thrilling to see it live anywhere. And then, you know, finally, the people from Yuck Yucks, Toronto, they came down to visit because they want to see who's this kid making noise in Ottawa. And I brought them to the punk club where I started. And
Who's that, Breslin?
Yeah, Breslin and another comic by the name of Steve Brender. And I remember them sitting there watching the punk crowd, you know, bouncing around, all this, you know, Clash playing loud in the background. And they turned to me and they said, "You do comedy here?" And I went, "Oh, yeah, every week. It's great. They love me here." Okay, this is different.
And did they book you?
Oh, yeah. And then it was a line in the sand because when I got to Toronto, there was a whole group of comedians, not a big group, but like 30 comedians.
Who were they?
Like Howie Mandel came out. You
was
know,
he
yuck,
the,
yuck.
One of the guys?
Oh, yeah. He was like
your
the
generation?
Biggest star at the time. And then Jim Carrey jumped in later on, you know. But Howie was the first big breakthrough
But
for
who
anybody.
Were the other core guys there, like when you were there, that you remember?
There's a bunch of people that you wouldn't recognize the names.
Well, let's
stuff.
Give them some love. Give a few of them some love. Are they still at it?
Very few. Like, most of them are behind the scenes now. I mean, there's still
smart.
A couple. Like, I think Steve Brender still does it. Evan Carter. And there's a couple of guys that still do stand-up. But for the most part, most of them are either behind the scenes or they dropped out. But it's also a thing, too, that the problem with Canada is they have that mentality of, you know, socialized medicine is okay, but socialized entertainment where they go to you, "Well, you've already had your turn." What do you mean I've already had my turn?
Oh, right.
What do you mean I can't do another special? The last, you know what I mean? Like, I had three specials up there on CBC and three down here on Showtime, and I thought, if I was just in the States doing it for a network here, they would have a piece of paper that made me sign not to go anywhere else.
For a year, anyway.
But for Canada, their attitude was like, "Okay, you've had three, you've had your turn.
Come back when your body changes."
I go, "Wait a minute, That's a crazy attitude."
And that's
for
still that,
entertainment.
I wonder if it's still that way.
Yeah, a little bit for a lot of us. I mean, it is certainly for me. They consider me, I've, you know, having had the turn.
So when you get down to Toronto, when you're doing Yucks and you're part of the crew of guys, and now did he open up all those clubs across Canada at once?
Yeah, so, I mean, I actually open up, in the early days, I open up the majority of them. I was the first act to play there. And then after me, of course, you had people like Norm Macdonald
yeah.
and Jeremy Hotz and stuff. You yeah. know, so they brought up the second wave.
And, do they all look at you as like one of the granddaddies of modern Canadian comedy?
A little bit, you know, it's a little like having an older brother, one grade ahead kind yeah. of deal. But
so, where does when does the drug start?
Immediately, as soon as I got to Toronto, what's this? Hey,
yeah,
what's
yeah,
this?
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you get offered like all these drugs, and I yeah. couldn't believe it. And yeah, Toronto was like, you know, Toronto always tried to be like New York, so we had a little bit of.
All the stuff coming up.
All the debauchery.
And yeah,
then,
yeah.
And then, you know, being able to come down to L.A., like the only reason we got down to L.A. was Evening at the Improv was co-produced with a Canadian company. And one of the stipulations was each show had to have one Canadian act. So,
is that true at the
yeah.
beginning?
So that was our reason to be in the States and our first U.S. television exposure.
What was that, in the early 80s, mid-80s?
Oh,
when
yeah.
did that start?
Early.
Early, right? Because like
yeah.
I remember doing it in 89, and I think it was already about done when they
yeah.
were shooting them down at that Westwood Improv.
Yeah.
Like the huge one where they treated the TV show like just another night.
Yeah.
Like I was doing my first TV appearance, and like I think Spade was there, and he's like, nah, I've done a few of these. And like it was just like no big deal. And to me, it was like the biggest
weird.
Deal.
Yeah, it, towards the end of the 80s, it really got saturated on TV. There were so many
yeah.
stand-up shows that it had to die down a little bit.
Yeah, I did my first, the first appearances were in 89.
Yeah. But it was nice, but coming out to, you know, L.A. and meeting people like Sam Kinison and stuff, yeah, there was an introduction to do the debauchery down here, which was on a higher level, obviously, because he had more years to practice.
More years to practice and more, I would imagine.
Started in the 20s here, apparently.
Yeah.
If you read some of the Fatty Arbuckle, what yeah, the yeah. hell happened?
Oh,
you know,
it goes
I mean,
way back.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Way back.
The documented debauchery. We don't know about the undocumented debauchery, except for the parties we were at. but so you're too like you're a big act in Canada.
I'm known to a certain amount of people. Like when people ask me if I tour, I go like Lady Gaga tours. I just show up occasionally at certain places.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but like at the time, like when you got down here. Because I guess I think I met you over the years, you know, at different places, and you were definitely, you seem pretty good. You look pretty well. You seem relaxed. But, like, there were times where, like, I was just happy to see a guy that seemed more angry than I was at the time because I was just a kid. But also just sort of, like, you know, off stage, there was, like, you were, like, just frenetic and just fucking, like, oh, my God, this guy's about to pop.
Yeah, there was that period.
You get on stage and right away it was like, oh, Jesus,
oh, yeah.
what's happening?
And it was a lot of peer group pressure. Like I'd read, oh, John Belushi did what? Well, I got to try a speedball. I got to, you know, like everything Pryor did. Well, I got to try that because Richard Pryor.
You were that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Kennison was like that, too.
Yeah.
This weird sort of like, you know, I'll show them.
Yeah, I got to try it. I'll represent my group.
I think Kennison actually went up to the chateau to do it. Like that was where he was yeah. like that. But so did you get strung out?
I was a heroin addict for a couple of years. But then again, when other comedians would ask me how I quit and I tell them, I got on my knees, I prayed and the I didn't
obsession
even go through
was
withdrawals. It stopped.
Really?
And like the following week I played at a club in Atlanta, which was notorious for paying us off in drugs. And I just, no thanks, I quit, you know, and I was very lucky. I don't know really how
did
it
you stop
happened.
Everything or you just stopped
yeah,
that?
Yeah, everything.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's been a long time?
It's been, what, 30 years almost with no hard drugs
no
whatsoever.
Shit.
I mean, after my liver transplant, I asked my doctors if it was okay to smoke pot. And I was surprised that the head doctor, Toronto General Hospital, he said, we'd prefer you to eat it than smoke it. So
yeah.
So now occasionally I'll have a brownie or something, that's it.
So was the liver thing, was that from drugs or alcohol?
Yeah,
it seems a long time back. You must have really
I contracted
it
Hep
in.
C, and then that caused the liver damage.
Oh,
and when I went public with it, a whole bunch of people from that era, the punk scene in Ottawa, they contacted me and said, "I have it too. I have it too. I have it too." And then But when I asked them of how they got it, and they said, well, I never used needles. And then I thought, well, how did we all get it from the same time period and half of us didn't use needles? It was from the saliva on the dollar bills that we passed when we snorted any drugs.
Seriously?
Yeah, the blood, you know, Coke was cut with a bunch of stuff to make,
sure,
you know, make profit. And if you had a cut in your nose, the saliva and the blood
really
would you know, and as soon as you make contact with somebody else's blood, welcome to the club.
You're, yeah,
part of the Hep C. But I was surprised it lay dormant in my body for almost 23 years.
You had no idea you had it.
Yeah, I was just going along. I thought I was getting tired of being on the road a lot, but my wife suggested I go for a checkup when I visited my father in the who was in the hospital in Ottawa, and a Canadian doctor found out the real problem within one or two blood tests.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, and it was
LA doctors had totally, well, you're just tired from being on the road. They didn't find out the reason. But
and how long ago was that diagnosis?
I had my liver transplant March 2013, so it was about 2 years before that when I was diagnosed with the Hep C.
You just missed the cure.
Yeah. So I literally had to stay in Canada. When I was diagnosed, my father, who was still in the hospital, he said, you can't go back to the States because you'll die. And I said, yeah, you're right. So my wife had to endure doing renovations to sell our house in Glendale for a whole year by herself. And then she rejoined me in Ottawa a year later.
So let's backtrack a bit, because so you had a house in Glendale, and you know, you're one of these guys, not unlike, you know, Scheidner and some other cats that, you know, like, were really able to make a living during the 80s. But were there, once you moved down here, what year did you move down here?
I think it was 88, 89.
So, you know, kind of late after the boom. So you were living in Canada but touring America, right?
Well, even when I lived down here, the majority of my stand-up was done in Canada because I was just more well-known and it was easier to get gigs.
But was there opportunities that happened down here? Did you get, like, deals and shit?
A little bit, but I have a whole history of the bad luck. I mean, 1 year I was put on a holding deal with CBS, and I was given $60,000. $60,000 for the holding deal, $60,000 to write a pilot. Went through the whole rigmarole, and just before we shot the pilot, the CBS president says no. And he says no to the independent producer who's been channeling me through,
right?
And the reason was, this guy had been the president last year,
right?
And he had treated his right hand man poorly, so now the right hand man, who's the current president,
sure,
said, this is all. And so I'm sitting there going, this
collateral damage.
Yeah collateral damage for $120,000, and this is how Hollywood works. Oh my god.
But you got the bread, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah,
yeah.
But I had a series of bad luck stuff like that, you know, like I got a new agent and he said, okay, we're gonna put you where you belong. I got my two biggest clients, Steve Martin and John Candy, work for the next 5 years. Let's concentrate on Mike down. I go, oh, yeah, great. We finally found somebody. 3 days later, he gets up in the middle of the night, has a drink of water, has a heart attack. And I'm going, oh, my God.
He's dead?
Know? Yeah. So I have a series of three or four people that have died once they realized that I was good, that I would be good for them. And so the joke after a while was, don't like me too much, because right, if you want to live.
Maybe you were being truthful with Sam. Yeah, maybe the souls. You needed the souls so you could live.
Yeah, I had a string of bad luck. I never understood. And then, of course, there was the stuff that I used to hate was going on these auditions where the manager and agent would say, oh, yeah, they asked for you.
Yeah.
Oh, they saw your special. They love you. And I'd go there and there'd be 15 Chinese guys. And I'm going, what the hell am I doing? And then the casting guy would come out, and you are?
Yeah,
and
of course.
And I go, why you?
it takes a long time to realize they're lying to
you. Yeah, I just couldn't handle that. And then I was diagnosed in 1993 with bipolar manic depressive. And that just flipped me out. The moment I realized.
I remember that. I remember running into you like that. Yeah.
When I couldn't get on Letterman to promote the third special, and I was listening to my manager on the phone, and their attitude was, oh, we don't care that it's his third special, we don't need him on the show. And that's when I realized, oh my god, comedy's not like sports. No matter how good we are, there's there's no guarantee that we'll be playing on a team.
Oh, no, it's not a meritocracy. Yeah. No,
it's just like, and that flipped me out.
Worst.
Yeah, I wanted to check out at that point. I tried suicide a couple times.
You did?
Yeah, and then fortunately, I had a good experience in a psych ward in Glendale at the Adventist Hospital that turned me around. But I've been struggling with it ever since.
Wait, keep it in check. So you think that all the drugs outside of, you know, wanting to, you know, match your heroes.
Well, I certainly believe in the theory that the drugs escalated the effect of the mental illness.
Right, but do you believe that you were self-medicating?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For a lot of it, yeah.
Like, because were you always depressed? Did you actually have mania?
Well, my cycle, I would get really, really angry. I'd blow up.
That was your mania?
Yeah.
It wasn't really, like you really didn't go buy shit?
And then I would get really depressed and want to kill myself. You know,
it was For months on end?
Yeah, very simple cycle.
Ugh.
And I would just have these, what my wife would call episodes.
She'd stay with you through all this shit?
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. I've been with the same woman for 30 years, and she's seen me at my worst and my best, you know.
Wow. So when you say you tried to kill yourself, what do you mean? You really tried to?
Well, you know, the thing in California, I had this thing where I would get mad and I would storm out of the house because I didn't want to, you know, lay it on my wife completely.
Well, that was like proactive.
Well, a little bit. I mean, but it took a while before I just go, I better get out of here. So I drive by the gun store in Glendale and I'd say, oh, my God, if I would have signed up for it last week, I'd have the gun now or I could
kill it.
But it's that stupid 7-day waiting rule that they have in California,
right.
It's a very good law because most people calm down after 7 days.
Right,
you know, they don't stay in that state.
Well, it's like that Jimmy Tingle joke where the guy goes in to get a gun. It's like, I need a gun. And he says, well, there's a waiting period. And the guy goes, how long? And he's like, 7 days. Like, well, the guy will be gone by then.
Yeah. Exactly. So finally, one time I was mad again. I was having an episode and I said, okay, I'm going to go in there and sign up for the gun because I will get mad again.
Right. Planning ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so when I went in there, you know, Glendale's a Republican stronghold.
Yeah.
And I realized that immediately when I walked into the gun store, there was a poster of the Clintons with crosshairs on their faces. And
really?
I went, Republican gun store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm looking at the guns. I'm really shy because I'm not a gun person. Even though they're under glass, I got my hands behind my back and I'm like looking at them. And the guy comes over, oh, you're looking for a gun? For what purpose? And I said, security, which is, you know, the safe word for those people. Yeah, of course. Security.
Yeah.
He pulls out this gun and he goes, don't be fooled by the size. It has 14 in the clip and one in the chamber. And I said, oh, in case there's two of them. And nothing. nothing from the guy. He's just deadpan. Like, all right, let's look at this other gun. And finally, he pulls out this card and he says, look, I run a target range on the other side of town. Why don't you come, you know, buy some ammo, rent some guns, see which one you feel comfortable with, and then that's when it hit me. No 7-day waiting period.
If you kill yourself at the range?
At the target range. So I thought, oh, this is the plan. This is foolproof.
Yeah.
And the only thing that saved me was that thing in the back of my brain that my mother don't get caught with dirty underwear. So I had to go home and shower and change and stuff.
Really?
And while I was doing all that, my wife had left the house. She knew I was like overboard. She phones my manager and I'm just about to leave to go to the target range. I wrote the note and everything. And it's my manager on the phone, and fortunately, he also represented Dr. Drew Pinsky.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had Drew on the other line, and they talked me into going to the hospital. And my attitude was like, yeah, sure, I'll go to the hospital. But I've got that card. I can go anytime I want. So yeah, I'll go through the motions for you guys. And thankfully, it was a great experience at the psych ward that made me think, okay, maybe I'll give the medication a shot.
Pinsky stepped in?
Yeah.
He's a smart guy.
He convinced me to go to the hospital. I went, and I actually had a good stay. I mean, I was supposed to be there for 72 hours, but at the end of the 72 hours when they wanted to release me, I said, I really like it here. It's been great. I just participate in group therapy, and all I have to take a shower a day and fill out the food thing, you know, and it's fun. You know, these people are great, and I've got everybody's button. I can make everybody laugh. I felt like, you know, Jack Nicholson in the Cuckoo's Nest. I had everybody's button. There's this one kid, all I had to go was And he'd go, oh, that's a stay. He'd be laughing like crazy.
You're killing.
Yeah, I was worried. And I was coming, and no one could come, you know, no one could phone me, no one could visit me unless I said so. So it was the first time I had complete control over anything like that.
In your life.
Yeah, and so at the end of 72 hours, they go, okay, well, they diagnosed me as bipolar manic depressive. They gave me a prescription. I said, well, I really like it here. Is there any way I can stay? And the doctor goes, well, I can't answer that question morally, ethically. And I went, oh, I understand. I still want to kill myself. Sign here. So I stayed for 2 weeks, 72 hours at a time, but 2 weeks. Yeah, I still want to kill myself.
How long were you in there total? 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah. Best vacation I ever had. So, it was like, you know, some people like to go to the beach. I like going to the psych ward.
So they checked you in for the observation thing?
Yeah, well, it's a mandatory suicide watch for 72 hours.
So you got to the point where your manager knew, too, that you...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. When my wife told them all the stuff that was going on. And I was very lucky that I couldn't manipulate them to get out earlier, because that's what happened with Richard Jenny. At one point, he talked his way out of a 72-hour, you know, a mandatory suicide watch. And, you know, and like later we all, when we found out, we went, well, how did he, you know, they should have kept him in. They shouldn't have let him walk out in the middle of a 72-hour thing.
He had the real manic episodes, right? The paranoia and the...
Yeah, it was very unfortunate because here was another guy that,
generation, you knew that guy.
Yeah.
You want to know something fucked up? I was doing his weekend when he did it.
Wow.
That he was in bad enough shape that he canceled it. And it was just in one of these weird-ass coincidences. The Saturday night, we found out, you know, and like I didn't draw, you know, I guess they gave everyone the heads up. But
it's a crazy thing. Like I said in my acting.
But he had a lot of guns. You're lucky you didn't have any.
Well, yeah. I didn't know other than going to the target range. That was my big eureka plan.
That was your big plan. It's like, I'll show them a target. Yeah. I'll show them what a good shot I am.
And it was weird because I debated whether or not to bring it out on stage because I didn't want to influence somebody to go do it. But then 60 Minutes came out with a piece about it, and there's apparently 8 people a year do it in the United States.
At shooting ranges?
Yeah. And my first thought was, only 8? You know, I mean, I was surprised it was such a small number.
Was your other thought like, I thought that was my idea.
Yeah, wait a minute. But I figured if they talked about it, it's okay to say it. And then I mentioned, you know, like, you know, don't kill yourself at the end.
So you did bits about it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, everything was fodder for the act.
Always. Once you got rid of the tennis racket.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I learned a long time ago, I play the cards that I've been dealt. So I was dealt the addiction card, I was dealt the manic depressive, and now I'm dealt the transplant thing.
Wow. It's like, you're lucky, man. You're lucky.
I was very lucky.
But on a lot of levels, you know, you have this bad luck that you think you have in show business, but on the other side.
Yeah, the marriage thing, I've been very lucky that way. So, yeah, I have my good luck and I've had my bad luck.
So when you got out of the psych ward, what year was that?
I think 93.
Oh, yeah?
Something like that, yeah, 94.
And by that time, you're not using any drugs, but, you know, so they got you on some sort of medication that worked?
For a while, and then they said, well, okay, we have this new drug that you don't have to go through the same, like on lithium originally, I had to take a monthly blood test to make sure the levels were.
Yeah.
So they had a new drug that came in that you didn't have to do all the blood tests and stuff. So I said, oh, okay, great, I'll try that. And then there was a couple others. I tried one that it really affected me doing the stand-up where I was in a corp gig in Florida with, you know, old people. And I just went blank, white noise, and just I couldn't remember a word of my act. And I was so fortunate that after the gig, the guy who booked me, he's saying, what the hell, you know, you stopped 5 minutes into it, you couldn't do the show, what's wrong with you? Oh, I'm on this new drug, Topical, or whatever it was called, Topamax, I think it was. And he said, oh, my wife's been on that. She's been in bed for 2 years now. She can't function. Oh, okay. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So I was lucky again that
the
guy understood and said, okay.
How old were the people in the audience? Did they know the show was short?
Oh, yeah. They were really angry that I had stopped. And I was saying to them, as they were leaving, disgruntled, saying, oh, this is unprofessional, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I said, look, if this is the worst thing that happens to you today, God bless you. But think about from my end, I don't know what's going on. I can't function now. It's like, I think I have the worst of this.
And what'd they do to level you off? Are you leveled off now?
Yeah, they switched me off that drug to something else. It you know, the whole drug thing, it's like a crapshoot. You know, you find... You hopefully you can find something that has the least amount of side effects for you and it works, you know. But sometimes it takes trying 3-4 different medications before you find the one that works for you.
Did you always do a lot of corporate gigs?
To a point, you know. But it was always like, I used to always think it was funny because I would tell people, I can clear this room without saying fuck. You know, it's not that those swear words are not the ones you got to worry about. It's the ideas that you know, I can clear this room without swearing at all.
Yeah, that's a point of pride. Yeah. I can make everybody so sad and uncomfortable.
But it was funny, though, in Florida with the old people, I used to always do the joke when I did a corp gig. Yeah, the guy that booked me, he said, don't say the F word. Don't say the F word. Ah, what the hell? I'm going to say it. Funeral. All right, boom. And everybody's happy and everybody calms down and enjoys the show. But, I mean, it's ridiculous when they go, you know, like a person who's 98 years old, do you think they can't handle somebody saying fuck out loud?
Well, that's true. Yeah, the old
this
guy.
This guy's been through the war.
Yeah, you know? It's like, a couple of them.
Yeah.
I mean, did you know Rodney?
I met him briefly through Sam. One time I was in New York, he was there and Rodney was doing the headline set and Sam goes, hey, you want to meet him? I go, yeah, fine. You know, of course, you know, it's Rodney.
Yeah.
You know, we go in there and he doesn't even knock. He just opens the door. Rodney's in a bathrobe with a towel around his all sweaty. And he's doing a line of coke, right? Yeah. He looks up, he goes, hey, Sam. And he goes, hey, how you doing? And then he looks at me and he goes to Sam like, oh, who's this guy?
Yeah.
And Sam goes, no, he's cool. And then I go, oh, hi, Mr. Dangerfield. It was a fantastic set. Like every bit worked. I loved it. And it was a lot of it I had never heard before.
Yeah.
And then he turns to Sam and he goes, I thought you said he was cool. You know, and I thought, all right, I shouldn't say anything else for the rest of the night. I overstepped. I was a fan there
too
for
excited.
A minute.
Yeah.
I thought you said he was cool.
That must have been great. So you hung out with Sam a lot?
Occasionally, you know, like I could get his attention by, like, a lot of people at the time, they would get his attention by imitating Dice.
Mm-hmm.
But they would always imitate the certain voice, and I would go Dice had two voices,
yeah.
So I would tell him, why is Sam so upset with me? And that would make him turn around and go, oh, McDonald, oh, you bastard! I think Sam was the quintessential. Remember on the Ed Sullivan Show, they had these acts, the spinning plates.
Yeah,
they have the little band,
sure.
You know, and Sam was like that. Sam would go into a party and he'd go, "Oh, how you doing? Oh, Mark, how you doing? You son of a bitch! Oh, McDonald!" He'd spin all the plates.
Yeah, he was a charming motherfucker. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, people would realize he's not in the room anymore. He's somewhere in the bathroom doing drugs.
Yeah,
and all the plates would fall.
Where's Sam? What's going on? I thought I was going to get some drugs.
Hey, man,
he's going to do.
I thought it was on the inside.
Yeah. Everyone thought they were on the inside.
Yeah.
I had to reckon with a lot of that shit. Because look at that. That's an old picture of me and Sam up there when I was way out of my mind. But like, you know, he was like, you know, he really fucked with you, man. He's a real brain fucker, that guy.
He was a funny. I mean, he was one of those guys that made me laugh out loud.
It was fun to be around him. Like,
you know,
when he wasn't fucking attacking you or you weren't on his bad side.
But there's plenty of times now I wish that, like, Bill Hicks was still around. I wish Sam was still around because I'd like to hear their interpretation of what's going on now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we need a couple more voices on our side. Talking about it right
now. Everyone's talking about it, though, and like big mainstream guys are talking about it, and some of them are holding the line pretty well.
I was very surprised.
I'd be curious how Sam would feel about this guy. I don't know what side he would fall on, to be honest with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there could be a 50-50 on that. I could just see him at the inaugural ball. Oh, you pussies that wouldn't perform. Yeah. Oh, you son of a bitch.
You could.
Bruce Springsteen, fuck you.
Right.
You,
know, I you could.
See, yeah, I could see him.
You
could
definitely, like, I know what side Bill would be on. But Sam's a wild card. I think that he and Trump are a lot alike in
Sam
some ways.
Sam would spin his plate really good, maybe.
Well, I think that he and Donald would love each other. I really do.
Happy wild.
But yeah, I do. I do miss that renegade force in stand-up that you don't see it much. I mean, you know, Doug, you know, Stanhope's out there doing his thing, you know, and I think he's definitely of that ilk.
Yeah.
You know, and has real balls in that area. But the weird thing is, it was never a mainstream activity. So, you know, Sam was the only guy that broke through because he had the gimmick.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then he'd trick you. Because it's like, oh, shit, he just tricked us into, you know, thinking that was funny. Holy shit, am I fucked up? But, you know, but Bill was always outside of it. You know, so who are those guys now? There's only a handful at a time, but I don't know. I don't know who they are. You?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's anybody that matches the intensity of Sam now.
No.
You know, and that's what was always the yellers, the you know, that intensity of emotion was always attractive.
And he had those, you know, those
Sam was
those
a natural.
Preacher chops.
Oh, yeah. And, right. You know, the times that he would go into the preaching thing to show the audience that he used to do it. I was like,
crazy.
Oh, yeah, this guy could have been, you know, he could have been Jimmy Swagger. He could have made a ton of money that way,
that
too.
Was the plan originally. Yeah.
And the same debauchery would happen.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
But sure, but just, not as public.
Yeah, just be low key. You know?
Yeah, which was not his specialty. Yeah. Low key was not the trick. That was not the deal. So now let's talk about, you're still performing now. You're back at it.
Yeah. Full time again. Yeah.
And where do you go usually?
Usually just in Canada. You know, there's I keep finding work.
Yeah, has Breslin still run you?
To a point. You know, there's a certain amount of gigs that are yuck yucks, but I have a. Thankfully, I'm very lucky to have a couple of people that somehow they find these gigs for me, and they you know, and I really appreciate it, and I and they open for me and stuff like that. But
that's good.
It's nice to have people in your corner.
Well, walk me through. I've never said this before, but now I want to know. Walk me through a liver transplant. So like what? Yeah. So you find out that your liver's rotten, and what are the steps that have to happen?
Well, it's a weird thing because there was a window of opportunity that you had to be sick enough to be moved up the list.
Yeah.
But you also had to be well enough to survive the surgery.
Yeah.
So there was a point there where they said you have about two and a half months to live without the transplant.
Yeah.
It's now or never. And thankfully,
I remember when it happened. I remember you needed help.
Well, yeah.
I helped.
I was very surprised that they had a night at the Laugh Factory.
Right.
And Jamie and everything, they put together this thing where they sent me a check that I survived on for like 5 months.
Yeah, I don't remember. Was there a Kickstarter or somewhere to send
something,
money?
Something, you know.
Yeah.
But I got a check that was way bigger than any Canadian conglomerate kind of situation.
And it kept you going. So, all right, so you got 2 months to live with the liver you have.
And I got the call and said, hey, we got the liver. You have to drive. So I had to drive to Toronto. They said, you got 8 hours to get here or else we have to give it to the next person. So I looked at my wife. My wife said, let's pack. And she drove me to Toronto, which was like a...
From where?
From Ottawa, which is like a 6-hour drive.
So you're up there because you were sick. You had to be up there.
Yeah. I was living with my mother at the time. And then, you know, my wife joined me finally.
Yeah.
But they phoned and we had to zip to Toronto in record time and we got there and everything. But I had no idea, like the liver doesn't get the press the heart and the lungs do, you know? But the liver controls not only everything physical, but everything mental. So although the transplant was a total success, my bipolarism was it hit the stratosphere with the reaction to all the drugs I had to take for the transplant. So within 3 weeks of my initial release from the hospital, I was readmitted to the Toronto General Hospital psych ward. I spent 26
days. So you got the liver.
Yeah, I was catatonic suicidal again.
You got the liver and it's taking.
Yeah, everything was a success as far as the actual operation. But then the mental health thing complicated everything.
And there you are, scarred and weak, and you got to go back to the psych ward?
Catatonic, you went back in the psych ward, and they couldn't do anything for me.
But they knew, they were able to connect the fact that you had the new liver with...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was still the procedures I had to follow for the new liver stuff. Like, I had to take, you know, 6 to 8 pills but twice a day type of thing.
But who made the connection that the liver had some impact on the brain?
It was, like, immediately when I saw a psychiatrist.
Oh, really?
They said, oh, he's the liver. Yeah, that's the reason. We got to get him in here, and we got to. But they had no idea how to because I didn't want to participate in anything. I didn't want to talk. I said one or two words the whole day, and they just freaked out. They put me on Ritalin, yeah. You know, just to get me emotional about anything.
Yeah.
I was just sitting there going, I don't care. I don't, you know. The doctor would come in and go, have you had any suicidal thoughts today? And I go, not till you came in. And he'd write that down, not till I came in. And I go, if you don't know if that was a joke, you're not going to help. Ah, you people are idiots. You know, we have a great healthcare system in Canada, but we have room for improvement when it comes to mental health. I think in general, like the whole world needs to up its game with the mental health.
So how long are you in, like, sort of like that zone of, like, what is this going to take?
It was a good 6 months before I even tried to, you know, make a joke or, you know, feel normal again. And then it was like another year before I got comfortable on stage.
But in terms of, like, it actually not rejecting, how long does that take?
Oh, well, it's there was never, I mean, that took right away. But I also realized the importance of I had to take the anti-rejection drugs twice a day, every day.
For how long?
The rest of my life.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's
no kidding.
You know, either you're in, you're out. You know what I mean?
Right, so, right.
But I resigned myself a long time ago with the mental health thing that, yeah, if a pill works, I'm taking it.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not one of those people that have problems taking
with
pills.
The edge? You're going to lose your edge? You had enough of your edge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the weird thing about after the transplant, I completely forgot everything I'd ever written.
Really?
I couldn't remember a word of my act. And one night in the hospital, I came to in the middle of the night, and I had left the TV on, the little hospital bed TV.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, and it was me at Just for Laughs like 10 years
ago. One of those galas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was watching, and I couldn't believe that I was saying all these things in a row, and I couldn't understand how, what am I doing? And I thought, I had nightmares about having to get a day job, and, you know, like, what am I qualified for?
Yeah.
A security guard? That's about it.
Right.
And that's, you know, it was...
So you had to
I had to virtually start over. And the only nice thing about it was when I went to these open mics every night, they were thrilled that I was there.
Really started over. So you got your psych meds leveled off. You're on your anti-rejection drugs. You know that you had an act at some point, but that was gone.
Yeah.
So you got to go to open mics.
Yeah.
And you're feeling it out.
And the only thing I can remember were the jokes I wrote about the recovery. So,
uh-huh.
And thankfully, most of them worked right away. So I was lucky that way. And then the people at the open mics, they would let me do as much time as I wanted because they were just thrilled that I was there. I went to everything. The most out of the way, like small little 30 people, whatever, I'd go and do, and you know, I had to start over.
And this was like 2013?
Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah, I had to start over. It took a good year to get anywhere near comfortable on stage again.
What did you feel fear? Or was it just sort of like, you know, you didn't think you were funny? Like, what was...
Well, it was just weird. And, you know, like I had to go back and watch tapes to learn to be myself again. And the only nice thing was I would laugh out loud at something, and then I'd realize, oh, wait a minute, that's mine. I can do it again. Oh, great, the greatest hits. So I got the new stuff. I got the greatest hits. All right, we're ready to headline again.
So everybody got to watch.
Yeah.
You put it back together.
Yeah, and they were all amazed that I, you know, came back because I looked really deathly before I got the liver transplant. There was plenty of exposure on the Canadian media and news shows. They followed the story.
Were you orange?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I look at pictures now. There was a point where 3 months in a row I took a picture of myself every day.
Yeah.
And I look at those pictures now and I go, oh, my God, I really was dead. People thought I was, you know, gonna
die.
Be dead. They were gonna pick up the paper and read.
I remember hearing that you were gonna be dead.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Making bets on.
Sure. Yeah, Stanhope's death pool. You beat it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, you look healthy. You look, you know,
it's not bad.
Full,
you know,
of life.
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. I like to lose a few pounds right now. That'd be the only thing. But yeah, for the most part, yeah.
And you're living back here.
No, I'm still living in Ottawa. That's where I had to resettle and stuff. But being here for the week, this is the first time I've been anywhere in the United States in 5 years.
Oh, yeah?
And being back in L.A. and stuff, there is that itch. There is that thing let's try it again.
Don't do it to yourself.
I'm worried. But I think I'm going to try the outside pitch. I have a couple of scripts that if I can get one of those anywhere, then maybe I can stay outside of Hollywood.
Come here without a reason, without some money.
Exactly.
Some incentive. But is it nice to be back in Ottawa? I mean, like, I go to Canada now and I'm like, whatever I used to think about it, I'm like, this is comfortable.
Well, yeah, it's a little, you just feel safer. Everything is calmer. And yet, we have everything, like what I call the best of the United States. We have HBO, we have all the movies and the games
Food.
And everything. But, the murder rate, no, you can keep that. We only want a quarter of that.
It's like America without the constant anxiety, without the panic.
Yeah.
There's just an intensity here where, like, and I know, like, I used to think when I got to Canada, well, this is odd. Why are these people sitting outside? It's nighttime. This guy's just riding his bike. What the fuck is happening? It's 10:30 at night.
Exactly.
Doesn't he know there's trouble at every turn?
Somebody could kill this guy.
Exactly. Like, I was like, what is happening?
You're an easy target. Yeah,
they're just walking at
night.
You just
open up your wallet. You're outside. What are you doing?
Right, exactly. But now I go up there, I'm like, this is all right.
Yeah.
People aren't like freaked out. Yeah. Everybody's hiding this freaked out.
It's just a little calmer.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's ironic when you see the statistics, like per capita, more Canadians have guns than Americans.
Yeah, but they're not nuts.
But the shootings are, the difference in the stats is amazing.
It's fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, do you know why that is?
They're just a little calmer. A little laid back. Like when you say somebody from Canada, you go, oh, Canada's a great country. Oh, thank you. We try.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
when you say America's the best, you're fucking right, it's the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking love it or leave it, buddy. Okay, easy.
Yeah, but I still wonder, like, I imagine growing up generationally over the years with the knowledge that, you will get health care. Whether it's good or bad or what, you just know that it's part of your life that know that's not a question.
No.
I think that means something.
Yeah, it's like the deal breaker in Canada is that the people don't mind paying high taxes because they know it's going to go for things like, health care.
And infrastructure. City.
That's the thing that Americans, I think, they forget. It's a good thing to pay tax. It's not something to admire, the fact that Trump didn't pay any taxes for X amount of years. It's more admirable to pay taxes because we all want people to live and have an education, this and that. There's things that
not so much here. The education and the living here, it's sort of like
here it's like, oh, I got away with it. I got away with it. Right. I got away with it.
Right.
It's not a thing to be admired.
I
got away with it.
I agree. And what do you think of your guy? That Trudeau fella.
Well, I've never been like a big political comedian.
But just living there. Is all right or no?
Of course, there's people up there that swear that he's the worst thing ever and blah, blah. And then the other go, well, yeah, but the last guy was worse and that. And it's always these arguments.
Sure.
I think the thing I hate the most about social media now is people have this intense desire to let people know what they don't like. I don't care what you don't like.
That's all of it.
Just tell us what you like.
Let me react to something in a negative way.
It's just, there's this intense desire.
But when you see that on a tweet or on Facebook, it's like, having a great day today. It's like, then everyone's like, ah, fuck you.
Yeah.
Who the fuck are you?
That's the response. What are you trying to pull? It's like,
well, I'm glad you're doing well, Mike. It was nice to see you. It was great talking to you finally.
Great, man. Thanks.
There you go. Some hardcore comedy show there. That's what that is. That's what this was. So what do you want to do? You go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. You can pre-order the book. You can get on the mailing list. Hopefully we'll all be alive and next week, tomorrow, whenever. But maybe I'll play some guitar that probably sounds familiar because I no longer know if I'm repeating myself, but I only play 3 chords in some variation and occasionally add a chord. I'm dealing with some new effects here.